Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, John E. O'Grady. John serves as Chair of the Estate Planning, Trust, and Probate Section of the Bar Association of San Francisco and is member of the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar of California, the San Francisco Estate Planning Council, the Association for Dispute Resolution of Northern California, the Association for Conflict Resolution and Community Boards. John earned his J.D. and LLM in taxation from Golden Gate University and B.A. from University of California, Berkeley. Since 1989, John has successfully mediated hundreds of inheritance, co-ownership, and business disputes. Seemingly insurmountable and unspeakable conflicts come to a resolution as a result of his attentive listening and thoughtful questions. Described as direct, empathetic, non-judgmental, John's persistent, calm demeanor is the foundation from which he skillfully guides people who are stuck in power struggles to come to terms and get beyond their conflicts. It's not easy to talk about death, wills, trusts, terminal illness, or loss. Conflicts about family money and elder care can put important relationships at risk. Mediator and estate planning lawyer John O'Grady's legacy is alive every time he guides people to resolve their battles so they stay connected and in conversation for a lifetime. Welcome, John O'Grady.
Thank you, John. Thank you, John. Is this on? Great, you can hear me. Okay, that's better. Well, welcome, everyone. We'll be talking about life and death, and some people think that probate and the trusts and wills and estate planning is all very boring. But tonight we're going to see some film clips that kind of bring it all to life. And estate planning is really all about communication. It is a communication. It's like the communication of a lifetime. When you do an estate plan, you say, based upon my life experience, this is what I want to happen when I die. This is who I am. This document reflects my values. I want my life's work to be divided this way between these organizations or individuals I love. So it's a very powerful personal statement. And often conflicts arise, and it's an opportunity to, have the difficult conversations, work the conflict, or deny the conflict. And the problems arise when the conflict is denied. And people are surprised after the death. That's when the problems occur. And so the solution is to communicate clearly and include your family in the discussion so that nobody is surprised. And let them know what you're doing, even if they don't agree with it. And so the first film clip is from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And it's about the spouse. And the first question in estate planning is, what does the client own? Because we can only give away property through a will or a trust that we own. If we don't own it, we can't leave it to anybody. And so with married people and domestic partners, the first question is, what is separate property? What is community property? And how do you know what's what? And, about 80% of Americans say that a prenuptial agreement is a great idea, but only about 7% of people getting married actually sign one. And I'm not going to show anything about prenuptial agreements, but this clip is more about the role of the spouse in the family inheritance conversation. You know, often it's not enough to have dad and mom and the kids in the room to have the discussion, because the spouse of one of the kids is really calling all the shots from the background. And so that's what this clip from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is about. Here it is.
Did you ever hear so many dogs' names tagged onto children? Think of it, they've got five monsters and number six coming up. Brought the whole bunch down here like animals to display at a county fair. So obvious, it's disgusting. Well, it's obvious what they're up to.
What are they up to, Maggie?
I'll tell you what they're up to, boy mine. They're up to cutting you out of your father's estate. Everybody knows Big Daddy's Dinah. Oh, I ought to send Sister Woman a bill for a new pair of stockings.
Do we?
Do we what?
Know that Big Daddy is dying of...
Well, don't you believe it?
You'll know soon enough.
Well, suppose he is. There's some things you gotta face, baby. There's some things in this world you've simply got to face. Why'd they have Big Daddy in that horrible old clinic for 6 weeks? The examination didn't show anything. Then why'd Brother Man bring his whole screaming tribe down here in this sticky heat? And why so many allusions to you and Rainbow Hill? You know what Rainbow Hill is? It's a place that's famous for treating famous alcoholics and dope fiends.
I'm not famous, Maggie.
No, and you don't take dope. Otherwise, you'd be a perfect candidate for Rainbow Hill. That's where Brother Man's going to tell Big Daddy to ship you. Over my dead body?
Rainbow Hill.
You out of the way. Brother Goober gets a hold of the estate and signs all the checks and cuts off our credit whenever he wants. How'd you like that, baby? Well, you're doing just about everything you can to aid and abet them and grabbing control after Big Daddy. Well, you are. Quitting work, devoting yourself to the occupation of drinking.
But I think you get the idea. The next three clips are from the movie 1,000 Acres, the book by Jane Smiley, based upon King Lear. And so it's, you know, the patriarch pitting the children against each other to do battle. And so we're going to see three very different family meetings about the same family's estate planning. Yes. No subtitles, sorry. But I'm working on it, Jim. Sorry. I can try to speak more clearly. Does that help?
No, I've been on
books. Yeah, no. But it's in the works. Thank you for asking. So the first clip from 1,000 Acres is the patriarch. He's had this farm in the family for three generations. He's getting old. He's thinking about his estate planning, and he's going to give it away to his three daughters and the husbands of the oldest two. The third daughter is single. She's a lawyer. She lives in the city. The others all live on the farm. And his idea is that all five of them, the two older daughters and their husbands and the younger daughter, are going to own and operate this farm together. And for good tax planning, he's going to give it to them now so that there's no estate tax to pay on it when he dies. And so here's the family discussion.
Big guy, his age.
Daddy was the most respected man in the county.
No farmer within 50 miles would make a decision without first consulting Larry Cook. Caroline came home every third weekend to visit him. They were always close. Somehow she seemed to understand him better than Rose and I did.
Our farm's been in the Cook family for 100 years. Provided us with a fine living. In my lifetime, it's become the most valuable property in the county. If I died tomorrow, you girls would be lumped with all those inheritance taxes, giving the government money for nothing.
Coffee, Daddy?
Well, there you have it. I have a plan.
What's the plan?
We're going to form a corporation. And you girls are all going to have shares. You girls and Ty, Pete, are going to run the show. We'll each have a third. Well, what do you say?
It's a good idea, Daddy. It's a great idea.
I don't know. I want to think about it.
You don't want it, my girl. You're out. Simple as that.
So the lawyer is the one who wants to think about it. And she's not so sure she wants to own this 1,000-acre farm with her two older sisters and their husbands. I mean, who would want that? And so just for saying, I want to think about it, she's disowned and disinherited. He won't even let her in the house anymore. And they used to be, she used to be his favorite. And so he was really making an announcement rather than having a discussion. And so that's an example of how not to have the family meeting. You know, and so the question is not only who's going to get what, but who wants what. A lot of times people don't want the asset that, you know, is the older generation is thinking to leave them. Like often, you know, they don't want any more stuff. I got enough stuff. Thank you very much. Send me a disc. Send it all. If you can get it, a photos, and you can get it on the computer in digital form, I'll take it. Otherwise, forget it. But there's a big burden to inheritance sometimes, especially when you're co-owning it with a sibling. It's just a recipe for disaster. Sometimes it works. But usually it's a court battle because one wants to put a new roof on the building and the other one doesn't. It's inevitable they're going to fight. So I'm not going to show the entire next film clip. It's the next family meeting in this family, and it happens to be at the courthouse. And I'll just show it.
Ms. Cook, when were your suspicions aroused about this plan going on for the division of the Cook farm?
Oh, I was suspicious from the first. The whole project was very atypical for my father, and I made my reservations known.
And how were your reservations greeted?
My sister, Ginny Smith, urged me very strongly to go along with the plan.
What did you think of that?
Well, I suspected her of ulterior motives. I know both she and Rose have wanted to get their hands on the property.
Oh, my God, this is...
Objection, Your Honor.
Quiet, Mrs. Lewis. The objection is sustained.
Mr. Ty Smith told you that your sisters sent your father out into a terrible storm, did he not?
Yes, he did.
He did?
It was common knowledge that my father was out in that storm.
I'm not surprised.
Ms. Cook, the relationship between your father and your sisters is irrelevant in this case. The mismanagement or abuse clause in the pre-incorporation agreement refers to the farm properties only.
Ms. Cook, in the past, had the Cook farm ever incurred debt?
No.
Is it now burdened with debt?
Yes, it certainly is.
No further questions.
No questions.
Witnesses excused.
So work crews were doing very long hours overtime?
Yes.
In order to push the work past the point of no return?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained. Rephrase, counsel.
Everything was done in a rush, right?
Well, the sooner the work was finished, the sooner we'd start earning.
Didn't you tell your husband, Ty Smith, that the big dollars being spent made you giddy? Did you tell your husband the big dollars being spent made you giddy?
Yes, but that was...
In other words, you and your husband were way overextended, and you both knew it.
No.
Your Honor, at this time, I'd like to call Mr. Larry Cook to the stand.
He's been saving it all up for this moment. Brace yourself.
Mr. Cook, did you in good faith form a corporation and relinquish your farm to your two older daughters, Rose Cook Lewis and Virginia Cook Smith, and their husbands, Tyler Smith and Peter Lewis?
Mr. Cook?
By God, they'll starve. Land won't produce for the likes of them.
Larry, did you sign the farm over to Jenny and Rose?
I don't care about going to jail.
Nobody's going to jail, Larry. It isn't that kind of trial. We're talking about the farm. Your farm. The one your dad and granddad built. What happened to it?
It was all underwater. I told him that. Every last bit of it underwater. We laid the tiles.
Yes.
Dug the drainage well. No machinery. Did it all by hand. My granddad, my dad, and me.
Yes, your farm.
My farm.
What'd you do with it?
I lost it.
How? Larry? Oh. Larry, listen to me. What happened to the farm? Who'd you give it to?
Them! Them bitches!
Here it comes. Mr. Cook.
Larry.
He's dead, you know.
Who's dead, Mr. Cook?
My daughter.
Which daughter? All of your daughters are in this courtroom, sir.
Caroline! Caroline's dead. I think they stole the body and buried it already.
Daddy, I'm right here.
Judge, here's Exhibit A, the contract.
It's a tragic scene. It's surprisingly common, though. And you can see the older adult kind of changed his mind and then reconciled with the youngest daughter and sued the people that he gave the farm to. You know, in the movies, they lost the case. And I don't know how it would turn out in California. There's too many variables, but yes. Oh, I'm sorry. The father lost the case. So the judge said, you made a gift. It's too late to take it back. And you can see he's losing capacity, you know, and often there are capacity issues, and that's when the fight really begins, because the older adult can't take a position and stick with it, and the older adult becomes easily influenced, and the rivalrous children are having their power struggles, and they're all wanting control. And so, but these kinds of problems are entirely avoidable with good communication and good planning. And most people think there's nothing to talk about. My kids will never fight. You know, or I explained everything to my kids about what we're doing and they understand it, you know, and then I talk to the kids and the kids say, oh, mom and dad mentioned it, but we haven't seen the documents and I don't really know what they're doing. David.
The same question of another speaker in this very room, I think, about a year ago. Years ago, I took a workshop on inheritance, and the leaders persuaded me that, you know, openness was a wonderful thing. And so I was very open with my sister about the fact that I didn't plan on leaving anything to her daughters, and she was upset about that. And so what would you have recommended that I have done differently?
Oh, I don't make a recommendation. I recommend that you be prepared for the consequences of your actions, whatever they may be. And so there's a risk to not saying, and there's a risk to saying. And my job is to help people make more informed, conscious decisions. Part of the problem, you know, if you tell them what your plan is and then you change the plan, then you kind of have to tell them that you changed the plan. But if you ask someone, if you tell someone you're not going to leave anything to them, they're probably not going to leave anything to you. Or if you ask someone to be your trustee of your trust, chances are they're going to want you to be the trustee of their trust. And it's a thankless job. Same with guardian of the kids. We have a hard time getting the older generation, the kids, baby boomers. We want the parents to do the estate planning because, you know, I know that, you know, my parents are both gone, but I knew that it would all fall on my shoulders because, you know, I'm the oldest. I know how to do this. I have 5 younger siblings. I just knew it was going to be my problem. And so I bugged my parents for 10 years to go to a lawyer. And they finally did. But it was no fun for 10 years. I was nagging. And it's not a very effective way. So I found a better way. The better way is to get your own documents up to date and then talk about how good it feels to have it all up to date. And people celebrate. When they come to my office to sign the documents, they celebrate. I mean, I have some clients who are Buddhist monks and they own some real estate and they do bowing and chanting and incense right there in my office because they're facing death and facing death is big in Buddhism. And other people go out for a beer, but almost everybody celebrates somehow because even for people with the simplest situation, like it's on the bottom of everyone's to-do list, but when they finally face it and sign the documents, regardless of how simple or complex it looks to be on the surface, it's a big deal to have a plan. And sometimes they get stuck, and I tell them, you know, it's only a plan. Just sign something and live with it for a few years, and you'll get more information about whether that's what you really want. As the few years go by, and you can always change it as long as you're alive. But the celebration is big, and I say, you know, that you're not living fully if you can't face death. Some famous person said something about, you know, looking death in the eye and winking at it. I like that way of describing it, but that's what we do in estate planning, and it's not easy. And there's no one answer, David. Sorry. So the next film clip is about kind of the burden of inheritance in the same family. And you'll see that the two older sisters who won the lawsuit, they get to keep the farm. They don't want it anymore. One of them's at the hospital. They're at the hospital. One of them's dying of cancer. And she says, this insanity has got to stop. This farm has torn us and our family apart. It's got to stop. And I'm not leaving it to the younger generation because I want them to have something we never had. I want them to have hope. She wants them to have, like, the incentive to get the hell out of there and create a life for themselves rather than kind of chase this asset around.
I want to tell you some things, some practical things. I'm leaving the farm to you and Caroline, not to the girls. I want all of this to stop with our generation.
Rose, I don't want a farm.
You won't have to. Marv Carson will make you sell to the Midwestern Corporation. I don't know what there's going to be above and beyond the debt and the taxes.
Rose died that afternoon. Daddy died of a heart attack that next spring. Our 1,000 acres were taken over by a giant agricultural corporation. The houses were bulldozed to make room for more crops. And although the farm and all of its gifts and burdens are scattered now, my inheritance is with me and Rose's children. As each year goes by, I watch them grow, and in them I see something new, something my sister and I never had. I see hope.
As you can see, these film clips are very powerful ways of kind of illustrating some of the family dynamics that go on. I mean, the sibling rivalry is entirely underrated in our culture. We don't talk about it much, but, you know, I think, you know, I can't imagine having a sibling without sibling rivalry. And I got 5 of them. But the question is, you know, not do you have sibling rivalry or are you going to die? The question is, like, can you talk about it? And, you know, one of the biggest questions that come up in estate planning is who's going to be the trustee? If I can't do it anymore, who's going to be in charge of my assets? Who's going to pay my bills if I have a stroke? Who's going to, you know, manage everything, administer everything, clean up everything, sort it all out when I die? And who's going to make sure that my intended beneficiaries actually get it without having to go to court? And often people choose a child. Often it's the oldest child. It's a hell of a burden. Being the oldest child can be a hell of a burden. But the trustee, when the oldest child, and I speak from experience, is the trustee, you know, I became like substitute parent. So any anger the younger siblings had at our parents, they directed at me. And that happens all the time. I mean, and often, you know, the family is in my office a week after the funeral of the parent. And I've never met most of the family members before. And one of them is trustee, but none of them have ever been to a lawyer before, and none of them have any idea of what a trustee does or how it works or what it's going to cost or how long it's going to take. And, you know, I work with them and educate them. And the trustee has a lot of duties to the beneficiaries. You have to account for every penny. You have to be really careful about how you make investments. You have to do exactly what the trust says. And it's really easy to mess up when you're trustee. And often the family member trustee says things like, oh, we don't follow the law in this family, or we don't do accountings in this family, even though they're required by law. And I'm the oldest, and so I'm in charge, and they have to listen to me. Tough. If they don't like it, they can sue me. And then the younger ones get really angry and they want to sue. And it can tear the family apart. But with good communication, sometimes it can work. But rare, that kind of good communication is a rare thing. Sometimes there's, you know, lots of fireworks in my office. And those are the best, the healthiest situations where the whole family can really talk about things and everyone can say what they want freely and nobody gets their feelings hurt. I help them fully have the conflict. And then when the dust settles, Mom and Dad can decide what they want to do. And at least everyone has been heard. And they may not like it, but at least, you know, their concerns were expressed. Choosing the trustee is it's one of the biggest questions, one of the things I spend the most time on with my clients. And there's no easy answer. There are professional independent trustees, and there are corporate trustees like banks. The individual trustees sometimes are more flexible, but they're also... they might not be around when you need them 20 or 25 years from now. The banks are more stable, and so they're more likely to be around, and sometimes they're less flexible. There's no perfect solution to who's going to be the trustee, but it requires careful consideration. It's a very important question.
John, there may be questions. Is there anyone that has a question to ask at this time? All right.
Hi. Is it prescribed by law how much the trustee is paid?
Yes, the law prescribes trustee compensation, and it's reasonable compensation, roughly. It turns out to be roughly 1 to 2%. It's a sliding scale. It depends upon the value of the assets in the trust, and it also depends upon the expertise of the individual trustee or the corporate trustee and the sophistication of the work involved, like were they selling real estate or what exactly were they doing? Yes. There's a mic for you.
Do you see a problem with co-trustees and, for example, a surviving spouse and, let's say, a brother of the first to die?
Oh, yes. Co-trustees are almost always a disaster. It's just like two people owning a building together. One wants to sell it, the other one wants to keep it. And so, you know, I know of many co-trustee situations that ended up in court because one wanted to do one thing, the other one wanted to do something else. And it's a lot of paperwork to sign, typically, and it's too difficult, awkward to include both of them in all the communications with the lawyer and the accountant. And it works out much better to have one person with the authority to make the necessary decisions. And I could tell you stories all night long about co-trustees and all the disasters. But I won't. Yes, next.
How long does a trustee have to hold those papers once the estate is liquidated? The backup documentation.
Yeah. How long does the trustee need to hold on to the paperwork after the estate is terminated? Well, there's no fixed answer, but at least 5 years. You know, these days... And usually you amass a big volume, you know, boxes of paper. And so it can, especially for someone, you know, with a business or something. And so it depends upon the situation, but at least 5 years. Yes.
Following on your comment about co-trustees never being or rarely being successful, as someone who wanted to have both families represented, the spouse and my own, and also with young children, my question is, well, it's a two-part question. What are the core attributes or skills of a trustee that you would advise? And then secondly, what do you think of as the relationship between the trustee and the identified guardian in a case where a parent of one of the families may be involved in either being the trustee or the guardian or both.
Okay. What are the skills necessary to be a trustee? Yeah, the most important skills are, well, I'll talk about Aunt Judy. Aunt Judy was an actual client of mine, and client was a single guy. He's dying of terminal illness. You know, a lot of people come to me with terminal illness, only when it's a crisis. And so in any event, he chose his sister-in-law, Aunt Judy, because she was, you know, in her 70s. She's retired. She has a lot of business experience. His two kids loved her and respected her, and he decided he did not want either one of them to be the co-trustee because they would fight with each other. And so he chose Aunt Judy, who turned out to be the perfect choice because Aunt Judy could kind of mediate the conflicts between these two adult kids after a client died about which one's going to get the condo and things like that. And the kids were involved. I mean, they were, it would have been a nightmare if one of those kids had been a trustee, the young adults. But Aunt Judy pulled it off nicely. It was a pretty sophisticated situation. It took a couple of years, and she did a fine job of it. And that's a situation where a family member trustee works out really well. And so ideally, you have somebody who knows the family that well, has the business experience, has the time, because Aunt Judy worked on that case full-time for 3 months at first, and then it was part-time for a couple of years after that. So it's got to be someone who's, like, loving, experienced, and available. And she didn't even charge any compensation. Often the family members waive the compensation. So those are the basic qualifications. You know, and she was open to legal advice. And so, you know, we talked often, and she followed my advice. Not everyone does. About the relationship with the guardian. Oh, and often, you know, in married people situations, often there's separate property and community property. So normally there's a community property trust and a separate property trust for each spouse, three trusts, if each spouse has separate property. And that's kind of how we deal with giving each spouse some say. About the guardians, you know, the thing that young families with young kids struggle with the most is who's going to be the guardian. In fact, that's the only thing that ever gets them to my office because they don't think they're going to die anytime soon. They're not too worried about the money. They're worried about who's going to raise the kids, and nobody can raise the kids as well as we can. And it's true. I mean, it's going to be a compromise because any suggested guardian is not going to be perfect. Sometimes they're too religious or not religious enough, or too much of a Democrat or too much of a Republican, or too vegetarian, whatever it is. And, you know, normally the parents have a hard time deciding who's going to be the guardian. That's the thing we spend a lot of time on. And sometimes it's, you know, wife's mother is going to be the guardian if we both die together. But husband's mother is going to get her for a month during the summers. So you can do it that way. Does that help? He has another question.
Yes. What happens if a trustee passes away before they fulfill their duty? Can the family of the trustee assume the responsibility, or does what happens here?
If the trustee dies while in office, you have to look at the trust document to see what it says. Normally, the trust document will say who's in line to be trustee next, and that person would take over. Yes.
Hi. I'm thinking about having my older sister as a trustee and, in case I die fairly shortly. And then, but in case she dies in the trust document, the second person would be a trusted friend. Some comments you would give me about having a trusted friend in that oldest child and sibling rivalry won't work in this because will cause a situation where I'm going outside the family. Could you discuss a little bit about a trusted friend using them and what I would pay them?
Yes, about the trusted friend. On the one hand, it's really helpful to have an outside trustee because you're not playing favorites. I mean, the big question is, you know, who does mommy love the most? Or who does daddy love the most? That's the question of which kid is going to be the trustee. And they're always confusing love and money all the time. And so an outside trustee is an independent trustee, and it's often a wise choice. But it's a big burden to put on a friend. I mean, it's not my family. And the friend can always decline when the time comes. And it's always a good idea to ask them for permission to name them ahead of time because some people will just say no right off the bat. And it's also a good idea to communicate with the family and let them know that that's what you're doing if they agree. And that way they might actually, you know, be able to do the job when the time comes. It's an awful lot to ask of a friend. I'd be reluctant. Although sometimes it makes sense. It's got to be a friend who has the interest in the family and the business experience and the time. The compensation. Well, normally, the trust document just says reasonable compensation, and I indicated earlier how that's kind of calculated roughly. But the problem with that compensation is that it's subject to income tax, you know, and what some people do is they leave the named person more money as a gift under the trust, which is tax-free. But then you don't know if the person's really going to take the job when the time comes, and you can't tie them together. And I can't recommend that you do that, but that's what some people do. Yes.
Are the people identified in a trust who receive a certain amount of money, for example, entitled to an accounting after the trust is disseminated? And if one discovers that a trustee has made other decisions that separate from what's defined in the trust, in other words, they spend it differently than the trust outlined,
right.
Is that legal to do?
Right. Well, that reminds me of the Martin Luther King estate. You know, Martin Luther King died with very little in the way of assets. Except the rights to his name, and he died without a will. And then his son was made executor, and son grew up. Anyway, the royalties from King's name now they're worth many millions of dollars, and so the son is managing these many millions. And in his capacity as executor, Sun worked out a movie deal with a studio to do a movie about King's life. But then his siblings started suing him because they didn't like the way he was doing the job of executor. And executor is very similar to trustee. It's the same basic responsibilities. But he didn't do the accountings properly, and they were worried that money disappeared. And they didn't like the movie deal because they felt their father's image was being overly commercialized, and so they sued. And they're entitled to an annual accounting of every penny. And And the beneficiaries feel they're entitled to it. They want it. But the trustees often don't want to be bothered, especially family member trustees. So they can go to court and they can get an order from the judge to compel an accounting. But that's an enormous headache and expense and the beneficiaries have to put up the money for legal fees to do it. And often they don't have it. In the Martin Luther King case, the movie studio said, forget it. We're not doing this movie about the King of Peace while his kids are litigating with each other. So when you settle your differences, let us know, and we'll do the movie. But they're still fighting, so we may never have a movie about Martin Luther King.
Two parts. One, if you don't have a friend or a family member as your trustee, what do you do, and what does it cost? And secondly, what to do if, say, you and your siblings inherited property with equal distribution among you. Is there a document or some kind of an order or whatever that would express how you're supposed to handle it?
Okay. First question first, about the trustee. If you don't have someone in mind to be trustee, you have two basic options. You can use a bank or a corporate trustee, and the corporate trustees are very sophisticated. They do this all the time. They get the job done right. They're pretty conservative. They're quite reliable. And they can be a good choice because you can count on them to be around for a long time to come. And some people complain that the banks are too expensive or too bureaucratic or inflexible. But at least the banks will be there for the long term, and some of them are better than others. Your other option is an individual private fiduciary. There are individuals who are bonded, insured, and they do this full-time, and they have reputations, and some of them are very good. They can be more flexible than a corporate trustee. But the problem with them is, you know, they're just individual human beings, and when you have a stroke 18 years from now, they might not be around anymore, so do you even bother interviewing them now? But there's no perfect solution. I'm sorry, you had another question. Remind me? All right. Right. Okay, got it. Okay, so the question is, if you inherit real estate with siblings, what do you do? Normally, one or more of the siblings doesn't really want the property. They'd rather have cash. In fact, 99% of beneficiaries prefer cash. And 96% of the time, the cash is spent within 5 years. And so everybody wants cash, and they want to know how much can I get and how quickly am I going to get it. That's what they're concerned about. But if you end up inheriting real estate with siblings, you have to be really careful because there's a parent-child exclusion from reassessment. But if the kids inherit, you know, a 1/4 interest in the property each, and then the kids sell their interest to each other, that's not a parent-child transfer, so there's no exclusion from reassessment. But most trusts provide for what's called non-pro rata distribution of the real estate. So the trustee is allowed to distribute the real estate to one child and cash to the rest to equalize it. That's the best way to do it. And there are variations on that theme. I have, I passed out some written materials. There's a lot more on my website, and there's an article on that topic, a couple of them on my website under resources. There's also, you know, income tax considerations, estate tax considerations, which I'm not going to get into tonight, but there is a article about estate tax on my website. Yes. Hold it. Let me get back to you in the back, please.
Thank you.
I think that she's next, John.
Okay.
Unless you have a question.
I have to give station identification.
Yes.
And where is it? We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. You are listening to John E. O'Grady, and the program is Estate Planning in Film.
Before I forget, I want to say something, too, my little station announcement here. I have a newsletter I send out by email every couple of months that has information and stories like the Martin Luther King story. I'll pass around a sign-up list in case you're interested in receiving it. And you have a question.
Yes, thank you. My natural choice of trustee would be my sister, but she lives in England. So my question is, how much of a hassle would it be if she were appointed the trustee living in another country? She's never lived here. She's been here, but what would it be like to navigate from another country?
It would be a nightmare.
So I should have someone local then.
Yeah. Part of the problem is that could make it a foreign trust, and then it's subject to all kinds of special tax rules for foreign trusts. And so it's a bad idea to have a foreign trustee. Plus, it's just better. There's a lot of phone calls, and it's just easier to have a more local trustee. Yes. Yes. Question in the back. Yes.
Yes, thank you. Since there's no real perfect solution to this dilemma, does that imply that there's flexibility or it's a living document? It's appropriate to go back in and modify it as time goes by, and is that correct, and how hard is that?
Exactly. And so, yes, the trust, you can amend the trust as long as you're alive and you have capacity. And so I tell people, just make some kind of decision for now, and you can look at it 3 years from now and change it if you want. But do something instead of sitting on the fence for the next 10 years. Yes, sir.
I just wondered if you could speak for a moment to do-it-yourself lawyering. All these do-it-yourself living trusts and living wills and that sort of stuff.
Yes. Well, the bigger question is like the cheap trust. And there are a variety of ways to get a cheap trust. Do-it-yourself is one. You see the promoters in the newspapers once in a while where they do them for a few hundred dollars. Another variation on the trust is the old trust that hasn't been updated in 15 years because someone didn't want to spend the money. So there are all these different, varieties of cheap trusts. And almost half of our work is salvaging cheap trusts after the death or after the incapacity. And it's a lot more work to do it when there's a crisis, than it would have been to do it, properly in the beginning. With that said, for people with, not a lot of assets, a do-it-yourself trust might work. Typically the legal fees are at least a few thousand dollars to go to a lawyer and get the trust and all the related documents. There's several documents, and there's a lot to think about in these documents. And so if you really want help thinking about all the different options with all the different documents, then you need a lawyer. And with people with more than, a couple hundred thousand, they have enough to, spend a few thousand dollars on and really think about it. But if your assets are, less than a couple hundred thousand, less than 150,000 or whatever it is, you might just be able to get away with a do-it-yourself trust if you pick a good one and you follow the instructions exactly. And there are statutory forms statutory will, statutory power of attorney, and statutory health care directive that kind of gives you the exact language you need and the exact instructions. But it's pretty tricky to follow the instructions. And one little mistake and the thing is invalid. Yes, sir.
I had one more question about the co-trustee. If a surviving spouse was to be a co-trustee with a corporate trustee, particularly with the management of real estate, and then there's a lot of relatives, that would inherit money after the second death. So the question has to do with the management of funds on the distribution of income from a Q-tip trust to the surviving spouse and any invasion of, let's say, principal from even a bypass trust, I guess.
Well, I think the question is about the possibility of having, you know, an individual family member trustee and a corporate co-trustee. Sometimes that can work. My preference is still to have just one trustee, you know, and the trustee can employ assistants. I mean, there's no reason the trustee can't employ somebody to help manage the real estate or whatever. But one good choice as trustee is usually better, although in some circumstances, having co-trustee, having a corporate trustee can be just the perfect thing. And sometimes people choose a trustee just to kind of give the young person, the chosen person, some experience and kind of challenge them to rise to the occasion and learn. And the corporate trustee, co-trustee, can help to bring them along and educate them. And some corporate trustees are more open to that arrangement than others. I think some of them won't even do it because they want to know what their authority and responsibility is. They want it to be clear.
John, we've reached a point where officially in our program we have time for one more question, but I presume you'll be willing to stay and answer more.
Certainly, and I want to come back and do part two.
All right.
Yes.
Would the audience want to hear part two and part three? All right. Okay. Well, we'd love to have you back. So in terms of the editor, we'll have one more question on record, and then after that we'll have some additional questions until you decide that you've had enough.
Okay.
Thank you.
Parents probably always think that their children get along fine and there won't be the sibling rivalry that you've had experience with. In dealing with the issue of trying to choose one of them, have you ever had families ask the children themselves to make the choice?
Yes, I recommend that all the time, Jim. And there are a variety of ways to do that. You know, often the parents think they have to decide all these things in a vacuum, and I think that's a big mistake. I mean, these decisions are really a great opening for a family meeting and a family conversation. You know, and why not just sit everyone down and say, this is the problem. We see, you know, these are the possible solutions to the problem. These are, you know, if we choose this one, this might be an issue, and if we choose this other one, in this other thing might be an issue, and we want to talk about it, and we want to hear what you have to say about it, so that it's just an opening for the conversation. It's a great opening, and there are these openings, too, about, and there's first, second, third choice for successor trustee, normally. And there's also for each asset that you're giving away in your trust or will, you want to list, like, the whole plan. If this person dies before I do, then it goes to this other one, et cetera, so that there's no possible way that there'll be any ambiguity about what's going to happen. But mainly, I say get the conversation going, and you know, I err inside of taking on the side of taking the risk, and they might not like it, but you know, it's your property, it's your decisions. And if you say something, if you want something that they don't want, it's just part of a conversation. It's the beginning of a conversation about why you want this other thing and how you still love them. Yeah.
John, we want to thank you for your comments tonight. We're going to close for the purposes of the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. John, please stay for additional questions. Thank you.